76.
WDCN-TV, Nashville, a service of the Metropolitan Board of Public Education. Certain portions of this program are adult in nature. Please use your own judgment about allowing young people to view it.
Major funding for Frontline is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this station and other public television stations nationwide, and by the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies, for over 100 years providing worldwide business and personal insurance through independent agents and brokers.
On Frontline tonight, a story of football. But it is not played on the field, nor cheered from the stands. The action of this story takes place off the field. It's a story about bookies. It's a story about the outlaw line, football, illegal gambling, and the mafia.
From the network of public television stations, a presentation of KCTS Seattle, WNET New York, WPBT Miami, WTVS Detroit, and WGBH Boston. This is Frontline with Jessica Savage.
As long as there have been professional sports, there's been gambling. But when you are talking about pro football gambling, you're talking about organized crime's major source of income, billions, which law enforcement agencies tell us are then used to fund other mob ventures, drugs and prostitution and racketeering. The NFL's only protection against mob influence is a rule prohibiting league members from associating with known gamblers or underworld figures. It is a rule enforced by an internal security department which reports to a commissioner hired by team owners. Is this enough to ensure fans a clean game? Ask yourself that question while you watch tonight's Frontline premiere broadcast. And one word of caution, there is one graphic sequence. Football is now America's favorite game. Football generates more illegal betting than all other sports combined. Every time a game is televised, the volume of betting goes up 600%.
Music, effect, go, Brent.
You are looking live at the Silverdome in Michigan.
At last year's Super Bowl, Americans bet over $5 billion.
Super Bowl 16, America's greatest sports spectacle.
Pan 20.
The two teams with the best records in football.
CBS Sports featured Jimmy the Greek Snyder. He was once convicted of illegal bookmaking. But this popular television tipster was granted a presidential pardon.
I'll have some inside information that nowhere else you'll find, and a choice that may just boggle your mind.
Take 14, Matt.
Super Bowl 16. Put on a pair of shoulder pads and get back into this thing.
In today's America, football betting recalls the days of prohibition. And illegal activity is widely tolerated by the public, and even encouraged by some of the nation's more respectable institutions.
He's thinking about it. Anderson is going to get in. We talked about this earlier.
How strong Anderson is.
When he jogs, his radio goes with him. This is Lem Banker. He makes his living from football betting. The latest scores are ticker taped into his kitchen. And a satellite dish keeps Lem Banker tuned into games being played in the 49 other states where football gambling is illegal. The gilded jacuzzi and the waterproof radio are prized possessions he paid for with football winnings. Because football betting is legal in Las Vegas.
Football betting is the fastest growing form of gambling in Las Vegas. The odds that govern football gambling originate here, in the legal casinos and sports books. Here, the ordinary public rubs shoulders with the serious bettors, the agents, the runners, the beards, the wise guys. Frontline filmed during the NFL players' strike, when only college games were being played. But the point spread works in the same way.
Harvard, 2. Penn State, 5.
In betting on the point spread, or line, you don't bet on which team will win or lose, but on the margin of victory. The point spread is a form of handicapping.
Florida, 13.
As the opening line is posted, Florida is favored by 13. Florida may win, but if it's by anything less than 13, those who bet on Florida will lose their money. The amount of money bet on a game can shift the points up or down. So several of those who come here are paid by illegal bookies and heavy bettors outside Nevada to phone in the latest changes. But the odds are not set first in the sports books, but by the outlaw line, which is inextricably linked to organized crime. Frank Mastrana, a convicted bookie. He's about as close to the outlaw line as you can get. Every Sunday afternoon, before the weekend's games are over, Frank Mastrana drives to his office. The scrap of paper on his dashboard is the outlaw line. In the next 7 days, $1 billion worth of bets, legal and illegal, will ride on these numbers. Frank Mastrana likes to claim that he sets the outlaw line. That's probably not true, but he is one of the first to get it, and this inside information is valuable.
Colgate, 7.5, 10.5, 3.5.
By the time he reaches his office, clients from all over the country are calling in for the earliest information about next week's point spread. According to the FBI, Mastrana's clients include several illegal bookies and gamblers, the kind of people who prefer to be known by code names or numbers.
Sports.
Sports?
Oh, Hollywood Fashion Plate. How are you?
Stores on 3. 7.
All right, 23. Well, let me know.
25.
Bookies everywhere base their point spreads on the outlaw line. That also includes Mastrana's legitimate clients.
The people that subscribe to my service and talk to me are the cream of the crop in the Las Vegas area. They're the managers of the legal books in town. They call me, get my opinion on the line, and then they use my line and incorporate it into theirs.
Tony the Ant Spilotro. The FBI calls him an enforcer for the Chicago family. He oversees those who set the outlaw line. This is Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano. Bookie, hitman, and the most senior mafioso ever to talk. Partially disguised, he agreed to be filmed for a fee.
Tony Spilotro's with the Chicago family. He's there to oversee things in Las Vegas for the Chicago family. And since he's been there, he's got all the bookmakers, all the gamblers, and he's controlled practically everything.
Historically, organized crime figures have plagued Las Vegas casinos with their hidden influence. As more and more casinos open sports books, that influence will surely grow. The biggest legal sports book in the world is at the Stardust. According to FBI affidavits, the Stardust has been secretly controlled by the Mafia's Chicago family. They ran a multi-million dollar skimming operation. They installed their own front man, Alan Glick. Glick is gone, but the skim continues. Barely a year ago, the FBI took photographs as the Stardust skim money was handed over in a parking lot. FBI sources say that Al Sachs, the present owner of the Stardust, is still beholden to the Chicago family.
So the place now is still under the Chicago family. They just put different people in there to operate it. Now it's Al Sachs. He belongs to the Chicago family. He didn't belong to it, but he is dominated by the Chicago family.
Al Sachs Casino takes more football action than any other sports book in Las Vegas. So even in Las Vegas, where football gambling is legal, the point spread is subject to the influence, direct and indirect, of organized crime. Every Sunday, the new point spread is broadcast on the Stardust's own radio show.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lee Pete along with Jim Brown from the beautiful Stardust Hotel. We will attempt to amuse you for the next 2 hours, and in that amusement, we're going to give you some totals for next week's football games plus the line.
The point spread that is put out legally in Las Vegas is picked up and published by newspapers everywhere, even newspapers like the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post. Such information supports the multi-billion dollar illegal gambling industry outside Las Vegas. With slickly packaged films cut to upbeat music, the NFL has created its own image. It is a carefully controlled image. Television has made that image part of American culture. But the NFL can do little to control the illegal football betting industry that constitutes a permanent threat to its image and its integrity. Sean McQueeney heads the FBI's Organized Crime Division.
There is a connection between organized crime and gambling in this country. The major metropolitan areas where we have our traditional families has controlled sports bookmaking for years.
Charlie Parsons, FBI Special Agent in Las Vegas.
Well, sports bookmaking in general, for years, has been considered the number one source of income for the mafia, the syndicate, the outfit.
$22 billion was bet on sports gambling in the United States. That was in September of 1980. Up since that time, there have been figures up to $25 billion and higher.
Out of sports bookmaking, pro football is king. It's number one by far as the amounts of money is wagered.
Frontline followed police as they mounted an undercover operation against an illegal bookie in the Fort Lauderdale area. Here, a police cameraman stakes out an illegal payoff.
You made a mistake. Only you made a mistake. He says, we're only up 7,000 something. I said, 7,000 something.
The bookie is known to the police as Bobby Olson. He doesn't know that the two men he's talking with are undercover policemen, or that this meeting is being videotaped. Police believe that Bobby Olson handles about $40,000 worth of football action a week. Even a street corner bookie like Bobby Olson will be connected to organized crime, according to this undercover officer.
I would place him as a mid-level bookmaker in a much larger organization. Part of his money he's paying either for protection from organized crime, giving him the right to work in the area. He's paying tribute money to him.
This is 63, go ahead.
The police set out to raid Bobby Olson. Like most bookies, he'll be hard to find because he likes to keep on the move. The only way to spot him is to look for his car. And when they know where he is, the police move in fast.
That's him. Bingo.
In some places, police are switching their attention from gambling to narcotics. But here in South Florida, a major entry point for drugs, the importance of bookies like Bobby Olson is not lost on police.
Bobby, open up. Bobby, you're under arrest. Lenny, you have the right to remain silent. You understand? Anything you can't say will be used against you in a court of law. You understand?
Gambling is the largest source of income into organized crime. A lot of people say it's narcotics, but I think the general opinion is that more money filters in and is used then to purchase narcotics, and it all comes basically from football betting, which is the biggest amount of volume business that a bookmaker will have.
Quietly, right?
As Bobby's clients call in, the police answer the phone and build their case against him.
The guy in the corner bar betting with a bookmaker, that bookmaker is going to be paying some of that money back into organized crime, so through funneling system. And that money is going to be used for narcotics or prostitution or any of their other illegal activities.
Evidence like this can disappear in a flash.
There are some special papers which allows a bookmaker to do this. One's called a flash paper. Anything hot really will set it afire. I have a piece here if you'd like me to demonstrate it for you. At first it burns very slow, but then it starts accelerating. And it's just a big ball of fire, and there are actually no residue left at all. This piece of paper is water soluble paper. It's sometimes referred to as rice paper, which when immersed in water, it just rapidly dissolves. Dip it into it and I try to pull it out, it just falls apart. And you can see the ink is just kind of fading away.
No one keeps records when it comes to illegal football gambling. But with billions of dollars bet on football each year, it's easy to understand why organized crime would be interested in any inside information. So the NFL warns all of its members annually to have no associations whatsoever with known gamblers. The NFL employs its own security force to make sure this does not happen. Preventing associations is the only way the NFL has of guarding against a fixed game.
Behind the walls of this top security prison is a man who says he helped fix four professional games a year in 1968, 69, and 70. He says he was part of a syndicate of illegal bookies and their mafia associates. John Piazza. In return for financial assistance to his wife, Piazza repeated a story he has already told law enforcement officers.
We had the coach, and we had the quarterback, who was the offensive captain, and we had the defensive captain.
With help like that, the syndicate was sure to beat the point spread.
Well, with the quarterback, if he knew the perimeters of the scores that we wanted to hold, maybe he was down close to scoring a touchdown. But a touchdown would have put it out of the reach of where we wanted to go. So he'd throw a bad pass or throw it out of bounds and only kick a field goal. So that he had control of where the points would fall. With a defensive back, if it got out of control and maybe somebody intercepted a pass and ran it back or something that the offense has no control over, then the defensive back could slip or let somebody beat him on coverage or something, you know, enough to control where the points would fall.
The coach was almost as important as the players.
Well, the coach, if you got a quarterback that's supposed to be a very, very good quarterback who has an extremely high percentage of completions, and then all of a sudden today he's throwing them in the ground and throwing them in the seats and throwing them at a lot of different places, you don't want the crowd to start yelling at the coach and the coach to pull the player out when we need him to protect our investment.
The purpose of this test is to determine your knowledge of and participation in payoffs for controlling the spread of points during a given professional football game. Have you voluntarily agreed to take this test?
Yes.
Frontline gave Piazza a lie detector test. These tests are not infallible, but this one found that he was telling the truth. He gave names, games, dates, and the actual amounts of money that changed hands.
The players that were involved, they were like a consortium. Okay, we would guarantee them $300,000. If there was three individuals, that would be $300,000 apiece. Plus, we'd give them 10% to 15% of what we took in. So if we took in $3 million, that means that they were going to get an extra $300,000. It could mount up to specific instance, $800,000 was the total payout.
Piazza remembers that instance well because he says he carried the cash to the players.
The intermediary arrived in a car with two football players that were on the team. And the only way that I would give the money to the intermediary was to recognize the people in the car that were the football players and for him to get in the car with them so them and the money left together. Otherwise, they might have been able to say that we didn't meet our commitment or we didn't fulfill our end of the bargain, or, you know, whatever. But I wanted to make sure that the money and them were in the same car. The instance that I was involved in was not the last time that we did this. And I'm sure that if they hadn't been paid for their previous activities, that they wouldn't have continued on. There's not a lot of group fellowship in this business.
Piazza's story serves to underscore the importance of the NFL's own rules on gambling. In addition to warning against accepting bribes or fixing games, the rules warn against, quote, any associating with gambling or with gambling activities. They are signed by Commissioner Pete Rozelle, the man whose job it is to make sure these rules are followed by every member of the league. Does the rule about associating with gamblers cover players and owners, managers, team members as well?
It would include everyone in the NFL, but of course you have to define the term gamblers. By gamblers, I assume you're talking about illegal gambling.
I'm talking about illegal gambling.
Yes, right. Continued associations after they know who the individuals are.
Why is that so important, Mr. Commissioner?
Oh, it goes to the integrity of the game. Our biggest problem is suspicion.
Suspicion first clouded the NFL during the 1946 championship game.
Polo Grounds, full championship game under a cloud. The Chicago Bears take the field against the grim New York Giants. Gamblers trying to make bribes involve two Giant players, including halfback Kilchuk.
The players had failed to report the bribes offered them. Officially, this is the only attempt to fix a game to which the NFL admits.
The Bears are champs, 24-14, and the good name of football is still intact.
In the early 1950s, the connection between mafia bosses like Frank Costello and convicted bookmakers like Frank Erickson were being exposed by the Senate Rackets Committee.
What is your bet?
My business? I have no business. I'm in jail.
Despite the occupational hazards, bookies and their mafia associates allegedly fixed a game in 1951.
We had a referee in years ago that participated in helping us with a game. There's a lot of ways, you know, that there's a penalty, calls a penalty, an offside penalty. In them days, they didn't have this this television replay. You know, they could get away with a lot of stuff.
Rozelle's first scandal came when Alex Karras admitted betting. Now Rozelle, who'd been warned about Karras, had to suspend him.
Of course, you make a mistake and you have a set.
Another player, Paul Horning, made the same mistake and was suspended too. But Rozelle did nothing when Horning was later seen with an illegal bookie. In 1970, news broke that a grand jury was interested in four quarterbacks, two college coaches, and a bookie.
A federal grand jury will begin hearing testimony in 2 weeks, January 20th, about the operations of perhaps the largest betting gambling operation in sports history.
The key man in the entire investigation is Don Dawson. It would appear he knows everybody who is anybody in sports.
As a college coach 10 years ago, Frank Cush often phoned gambler Don Dawson. But last year, Rozelle let Cush become an NFL coach.
We told the Baltimore Colts that we saw no reason why he would not be accepted as a coach at the time they hired him.
An IRS affidavit, an investigation showed that Frank Cush talked numerous times to known gambler Dice Dawson. Was that a thorough background check?
I'm sure that our security department evaluated that at the time. And
again, the fact that he knew someone and would talk to him a great number of times wouldn't necessarily mean would mean that he would know exactly what the man's business is.
Joe Namath had been linked to the Detroit grand jury. It was not his first brush with scandal. Broadway Joe, the swinging superstar of the late 60s, had started out as a bookies runner. Later, he could often be found playing liar's poker in a notorious nightclub. And for months, the NFL had known that Namath's own restaurant had become a hangout for bookies and gamblers.
1, 2, 3, hit! Go, go, go! No one else gets more like Broadway Joe!
When Manhattan police planned a raid on Namath's restaurant, Bachelor's 3, Pete Rozelle was forced to act fast. Namath was ordered to sell his place or quit the game.
I'm not selling. I'll quit.
Reporters spared the league and the tearful Namath the obvious question.
This is ridiculous.
Why hadn't Rozelle acted months earlier?
Well, when we learned of the problem at this Bachelor's 3 restaurant, we got all the information we could, and then I confronted Joe privately about it.
Is that vigorous enforcement?
I think that's as vigorous as we can do in the way of associations. If they're going to associate with individuals that are clearly in the outskirts of society, they're going to bring discredit to themselves, to the league, and continue the association and just flaunt it, then I think something can be done.
According to Pete Rozelle, the game's biggest threat is suspicion. In 1978, the average Redskin fan might have been suspicious if he had known that a bookmaker was friendly with a team member, and that in this game, the bookmaker bet against the Redskins. Recently, these reporters wrote that during a raid, police had found two players, one of whom was a Washington Redskin, Jake Scott, in the home of a bookmaker called Bernie Fuqua.
When the agents burst into Fuqua's house, there was Jake Scott on the sofa, and in a chair was Craig Hertwig, who at the time was an offensive lineman for the Buffalo Bills.
I forget when I did learn about that. I know that the two players involved, it was at the end of their career, and nothing was certainly ever established on them.
In fact, the newspaper reported that police told the NFL about the raid 3 years ago.
When we contacted Warren Welch, who is now the NFL security chief, he looked in the NFL files, and there was indeed a notice from Gary Garner of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation of the December raid on Fuqua's house and of Jake Scott's presence in Fuqua's house at the time of the raid.
Associating with a bookie can cause suspicion, even though there's no evidence that Scott, number 13, meant to miss this tackle and allow a touchdown. Despite that association, the NFL was apparently prepared to allow Jake Scott and Craig Hertwig to continue their playing careers.
They did not play during our regular season next year. They retired from football, not because of the incident, but they were near the end of their careers.
They played in the preseason the next year, however.
They reported to training camp, but they did not play in the regular season. Again, our Warren Welch, I think, would be the best one for you to talk about on the details of that.
They did not play in a regular season game after Fuqua's arrest in December of 1978.
But they did play a preseason game.
In 79, yes, they did. Mm-hmm.
The Oakland Raiders say they told the NFL 15 times that their star quarterback, Ken Stabler, had been seen with convicted bookmaker Nick Dudich. Still, the NFL did nothing. But a murder in Northern California changed that. Dudich had bet with bookmaker Whitey Green. After Green's murder, his runner, Gino Tropiano, began to talk about Dudich.
He's been seen with Kenny Stabler at more than a dozen games, and which was substantiated by other Raiders also. They said he used to take him to dinner and he was a good friend, and that they'd never talked football. And I don't know why in the world a bookmaker would want to to dinner with football players after a game and not talk football. What else is there to talk about?
The NFL asked Tropiano to take a lie detector test. Frontline did too and paid him a fee. Though the NFL's polygraph found Tropiano truthful, it chose to discount his story. Stabler has sued NBC News and the New York Times for their stories on his relationship with Dudich.
Stabler's association with Dudich is not illegal, but it could violate the National Football League Constitution. Each year, the NFL warns all players to avoid gamblers out of fear that the gamblers might attempt to bribe players to influence the outcome of games. The league's investigation of Stabler began in March, 3 years after first complaints about him reached league officials.
Has there ever been a case where the NFL's security force has done the investigation, found some wrongdoing with regard to association with gamblers, and then bring it to public attention first?
You're talking about 23 years I've had this job. I can't...
Could you name one, maybe in the last 5 years or any one of the 23 years?
I can't, because I know what our normal policy is for player fines on the field.
With regard to gambling, specifically with regard to gambling.
I say we don't make them public. That is our normal policy, unless they've come to public attention and it's important to clear an individual or to take some action. What I'm saying is each one of these is a subjective judgment. We do very much quietly. If there's an association involved, we learn of it, we talk to the individual, whether it be an owner or a player.
You could investigate the owners.
Owners as well as players, absolutely.
You do a thorough background check.
Our security department investigates all possible background on the individual coming in the league as an owner. They check the best of their knowledge on their associations, on their character, on their finances, if they are to be an owner in the league.
No owner had more dubious associations than the late Carol Rosenblum. In the late 1950s, he invested in this Cuban casino. In those days, Cuba's dictator, Batista, had thrown his country open to mafia-run gambling interests. Batista welcomed Rosenblum's partners, men like Mike McClaney, a stock swindler and tax evader, and Lou Chesler, a sometimes associate of mobster Meyer Lansky. Rosenblum shared Chesler's passion for betting on football. He used to bet against his own team, the Baltimore Colts, and was even accused of fixing games by leaving key players at home. In 1972, Rosenblum sold the Colts and bought the LA Rams, but he continued to play with fire, placing huge bets with mafia-linked bookies.
Well, he placed a big bet with us. Between Gil, Beckley, and Marty Scarloff, we had to lay it off all over the country. And I laid off $200,000 of it, and Gil and Marty handled laying off the rest of it. It was a total of $1 million.
Rosenblum used a bagman to courier his illegal bets in and out of Las Vegas. Identical briefcases would be exchanged in front of a newsstand. Victor Weiss was the man who carried Rosenblum's cash and placed his bets. But one day, in this hotel parking lot, homicide detectives found him, dead. He'd been shot in the head and bundled into the trunk of a red Rolls Royce.
He had what appeared to be a close relationship with the Rams. He used to spend Sundays on the home games in the Rams press box.
If he's betting either for himself or someone else, there are heavy wagers in the sports bookmaking, in particularly the NFL.
The murder of Weiss prompted questions about Rosenblum's own death just 2 months earlier. This is Golden Beach in Florida. Every year, Carol Rosenblum would come here, and every morning he would swim in the ocean. Until one day in April 1979, he drowned. His death still puzzles his son, Steve.
Here's a man that spent most of the 72 years in or around the water. In fact, had lived on that stretch of beach for about 8 years or so, and knew the ocean well. new undertows and the currents, and could handle himself very well in the water. And I just don't recall him ever going into the water by himself. My own feeling is, with all these circumstances and questions still in my mind, I don't believe that his death was accidental.
Gino Tropiano has heard the story that's common in criminal circles.
I think he was more or less murdered. He was held underwater until he drowned. One morning when he went to the ocean to swim, there was a guy in a wetsuit that was down below him, and he grabbed him by the ankles with his wetsuit so he couldn't go back up to breathe, and held him underwater until he drowned. And they brought him ashore, and a French-Canadian man was there and gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to no avail, and he's disappeared. And the fellow that held him under has disappeared.
The French-Canadian tourist did not try to revive Rosenblum. But according to a police report, he did swim out and try to save him. The report says that he failed to rescue the drowning man and that two policemen brought the body to shore. After that, the tourist went home to Montreal. Frontline asked a private investigator to contact the witness and sent him a copy of the police report. The death was accidental, according to the police report, which names the witness as Raymond Tanguay. A detective in the Mounties for 24 years, Eddie Noel verified that Tanguay has a completely clean police record.
Oui, est-ce que Jacques est là, s'il vous plaît?
Then, on a snowy Canadian night, Eddie Noel took us to meet Raymond Tanguay. Noel had already interviewed Tanguay extensively and found that his unique eyewitness account contains evidence that does not appear in the official version of events. It is important to remember that though the police arrived on the scene within minutes, Tanguay was the only person actually in the water and close to Rosenblum as he was drowning. Tanguay repeated his story about what he saw in the water.
Qu'est-ce que tu as vu quand tu es rentré dans l'eau?
J'ai vu premièrement Monsieur Rosenblum là.
He says that he saw Mr. Rosenblum out in the water and he was shouting for help.
Un affaire noir dans l'eau. Qui la veille à la faction.
As he was going out there, he saw a black object in the water. When he saw this object, it was going in the opposite direction of the waves and it sort of crossed over. He only saw it once as if it went underwater, submerged, and never came up again.
J'ai vu les deux hommes qui ils ont pogné Monsieur Rosenblum là, parce qu'il était dans
two men came out. They went into the water. The taller man of the two grabbed Mr. Rosenblum underneath the arms. The smaller one grabbed Mr. Rosenblum by the legs.
Moi, j'ai vu que j'étais en arrière.
By this time, Mr. Tanguay went over to assist them, and one of them told him not to touch Mr. Rosenblum and to get away from there. They then dragged the body to shore and left him on the shore, and the two that brought him in simply walked away and left the body on the shore.
Puis les deux hommes en question, ils ont parti.
Carol Rosenblum. His way of life raises questions about how he died. Rosenblum left some unfinished business behind him. According to a sworn deposition, Rosenblum and two other team owners had been scalping Super Bowl tickets for years. The year he died, the Rams had 27,000 Super Bowl tickets to sell. Rosenblum's widow, Georgia, has denied newspaper stories that she scalped any tickets. Nevertheless, Frontline has learned that the IRS is investigating the ticket scalping racket. IRS inquiries have centered on a Los Angeles hoodlum called Jack Catane.
I've never met him, but I've talked to him on the phone. But he's involved in a lot of things, illegal activities. in and around California and other parts of the country.
Dear Jack, I spoke to your attorney this day.
Attorney Tony Capozzola has been persuading Jack Catane to talk about the ticket scalping and to admit in writing that he once threatened Capozzola's clients, Harold Giver and Steve Rosenblum, for talking about the scam.
And Harold Giver told me that Mr. Catane had made it very clear that it was not in his best interest to say one more thing about the ticket scalping or any other derogatory thing about the Rams. And in fact, not only Harold Giver, but Steve Rosenblum would be in some sort of jeopardy if they continued to say anything about that. Just consider 10,000 tickets for a Super Bowl. If those tickets are sold at $100 over face value, there's $1 million in cash.
Stories about scalped Super Bowl tickets first surfaced in 1980. Catane's admission has never been reported, but Capozzola says he told Pete Rozelle 9 months ago.
Mr. Rozelle expressed his concern, said that he would like to know if the matter was not resolved, and that he planned to notify the appropriate people in the NFL, security, etc. I never heard from anybody in the NFL.
Commissioner Rozelle's job is not an easy one. Organized crime is always looking for associations. For a player, an association can be made over a drink at a bar. For a team owner, it could be through a business deal. Frontline has been examining a number of owner business associations. They are not illegal. They do not concern football teams. But they are of concern when we consider the NFL's own rule about questionable associations and how they can threaten the integrity of the game.
Across the bay from San Francisco is Oakland Stadium, once the home of the Raiders. When the owner of the Raiders, Al Davis, decided to move his team to Los Angeles, there was a legal battle with Pete Rozelle.
We thought we had a strong case going in, and we think that it came out that way in the evidence.
I think we made a strong case on our own.
During the legal preliminaries, much was learned about Al Davis's business connections.
We made a strong case there.
Davis had come to an attorney's office in San Mateo, California, to make a long sworn deposition. Frontline has obtained complete transcripts of that deposition. It details Davis's relationship with the casino owner, Alan Glick. At age 32, Glick bought himself four casinos in Las Vegas with the help of a $100 million loan from the mafia-dominated Central States Teamsters Pension Fund. FBI wiretaps showed Glick to be little more than a front man for mafia chieftains like Joey Iuppa. An FBI affidavit says, quote, Alan R. Glick is merely a straw party controlled by the organized crime syndicate and designated by them to be the licensee on paper in the state of Nevada. From this office building in La Jolla, California, Glick concluded several real estate deals with Al Davis. But one of the partners suspected she'd been swindled by Glick. So Tamara Rand threatened to go to the FBI.
Tamara Rand was a local businesswoman who we discovered on November 9, 1975, shot to death in the kitchen of her home in Mission Hills area of San Diego. We determined from our investigation that a weapon similar to this one was used as the death gun.
Tamara Rand's killer had shot her once in the ear and three times in the mouth with a silenced .22 caliber pistol.
From the type of the gun that was used, we determined that this was a gangland-style execution murder.
It was the Chicago family that killed her. Naturally, they were protecting their interests. They didn't want Glick to get dirtied up. And evidently, this Tamara Rand had a lot of information to give. So they killed her.
ill feeling among the other.
Al Davis's partnership with Alan Glick has been criticized by Pete Rozelle.
Well, I don't really have that much respect for Pete Rozelle, especially.
But Davis has done nothing to sever the relationship. Tom Meckling founded the National Commission on Gambling Information. It's an anti-gambling pressure group. Meckling's research has led him to delve into the business backgrounds of a number of football team owners. He talked to us about Davis's dealings with Glick.
The best deal that Glick ever made with Al Davis was to give him a one-quarter interest in a $25 million Teamster-funded shopping center, 33 acres, 85 stores, and so forth, for $5,000. One-quarter interest in a $25 million shopping center for $5,000?
Mr. Glick has never been convicted of anything. Nonetheless, because of the Las Vegas casino connection and the intense federal investigation of him, I suggested to Al Davis that it'd be best if he divorced himself from a shopping mall that Mr. Glick was involved in, I think, in Oakland. But Al Davis has chosen to retain his association, to best of my knowledge, in this Eastmont Mall in Oakland.
But Davis was by no means the only NFL member in business with Glick. Davis's sworn deposition lists a number of players. Quarterback John Hadel and receiver Lance Allworth were two of 15 who were for a while enticed into dealing with Glick. According to the depositions, several coaches struck bargains with Glick. Don Shula was one. When he found out about Glick, he severed the connection. But several unnamed owners had also formed limited partnerships with Alan Glick. The American public is largely unaware that some football team owners have associations that might be frowned on in a player. Edward DiBartolo was considered an unsuitable owner by Major League Baseball.
DiBartolo was turned down by Bowie Kuhn, who's very sensitive as a commissioner of baseball, to gambling interests, racetrack interests, and so forth.
But the NFL allowed DiBartolo to buy the 49ers and turn it over to his son. Al Davis was paid a $100,000 finder's fee.
Strangely enough, since he swung four times or never made a connection with a Major League Baseball team, he was able to make a very quick connection to become the owner of the San Francisco 49ers.
San Diego is the home of the Chargers. The owner is Eugene Klein. Eugene Klein has owned many buildings and properties through the years.
One of the strangest building places he had, along with some very strange people, was a small resort hotel in Acapulco, Mexico, called Acapulco Towers.
Sidney Korshak was one of Klein's partners in the Acapulco venture. He started his career in Chicago, giving legal advice to a member of Al Capone's gang.
Will you quit pestering me?
Not pestering you. We would like to ask you a couple of questions.
You're not going to ask me any questions.
Korshak's name has come up in more than 20 investigations into organized crime.
Korshak, of course, is best known by the terminology of the California Attorney General's office that said he is really the switching point between big business and organized crime.
Klein, the owner of the Chargers, was registered at the 21-room private hotel when police observed Meyer Lansky holding an underworld conference there.
And it was there that Meyer Lansky chose to bring in his compadres, and the Illinois Bureau of Investigation, which is part of the surveillance team, called it a very sunny place for shady characters.
Former Playboy executive Tony Roma. He was one of the shady characters enjoying the sun at Acapulco Towers with Meyer Lansky in 1970. Roma has been in business with the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Texas billionaire Clint Murchison.
Roma and Murchison are partners in a number of businesses. We got C.W. Merkison as president of this operation called Roma Lauderdale, Inc., which runs Tony Roma's restaurants. We have Tony Roma's vice president. There is a whole file on Roma in the Senate Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations.
The owner of the Cowboys also sought to do business with Mafia chieftain Carlos Marcello.
Merkison has tried to make a number of deals with Marcello, one of which was to buy his big estate. Another was to buy a bank that Marcello controls.
For 30 years, Carlos Marcello has been the boss of the New Orleans underworld, though he claims to be nothing more than an innocent tomato salesman.
To sell tomatoes?
Well.
Can you mention one person you sell tomatoes to?
So I'll take the Fifth Amendment because it may intend to incriminate.
Marcello's influence stretches into every aspect of New Orleans life. And in the past, that has included the football team. Gamblers and bookies associated with Marcello drew the new young owner of the Saints into a series of joint investments.
Meekin is a very rich son of a very rich father who was given the franchise at the age of 27. And then almost immediately got entwined with real estate deals. They all seemed to manage to get into real estate deals, which was being fronted by several people that were really Marcello's people.
You make a statement, NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle's reaction to disclosures of the nature you've just made were typical Rozelle-esque. What does that mean?
There seems to be a double standard operating in the National Football League. A commissioner is thought of as commissioner of all the league, the players, the fans, and the owners. But frankly, Rozelle, who's been in the office a long time, was handpicked by Carol Rosenblum and others, and they can fire him at any time, and it seems like he constantly tilts for the interests of the owners. For example, he seems to look the other way when these funny associations in business and otherwise of his owners become. Lamar Hunt, who owns the Kansas City Chiefs, put it quite pointedly. He said, a commissioner can be fired.
Do you ever feel there's a conflict of interest?
Not as long as you have a long-term contract.
Are you confident, as the NFL is currently constructed, you could investigate owners thoroughly with regard to association with gamblers?
Well, absolutely.
Do you have the power to tell an owner to divest himself of a questionable property the same way you would a player?
I don't have the power to force either to necessarily, but in extreme circumstances, I could test that power. It would probably mean a court case.
Do you think it might be necessary at this time to get some outside help with regard to policing the game and gambling?
Oh, I think it would be very difficult to say have a federal agency, which I assume is what you're suggesting, get involved in sports, because it wouldn't just be the NFL, it would be basketball, hockey, baseball. And I think that we just have to enforce these things ourselves, and I don't see that government agency could really help.
More money will ride on this year's Super Bowl than ever before. If the NFL fails to enforce its own rules, the sport will be ripe for corruption, because gamblers will do anything they can to get an inside edge. That is one sure bet.
Since Frontline interviewed Commissioner Rozelle, two new allegations have been made. One, John Piazza's charge that he helped fix four games a year in 1968, 69, and 70. Commissioner Rozelle told me he never heard of John Piazza and that, to his knowledge, there were no games fixed in that period. Two, as to ticket scalping, Commissioner Rozelle told me Anthony Capozzola brought him no new information, but he would neither confirm nor deny that the NFL is currently investigating the scalping of Super Bowl tickets. As we prepared this frontline investigation, we contacted NFL owners mentioned for their comments. Some did not respond. Davis of the Raiders, DeBartolo Jr. of the 49ers, Murkison of the Cowboys, and Frontieri of the Rams. A spokesman for Meekum of the Saints told Frontline that Mr. Meekum severed his business ties with the notorious gambler at the request of Pete Rozelle and that he had never knowingly done business with Marcello Associates. Klein of the Chargers spoke personally to Frontline. He told us he never knew the late Meyer Lansky. As to Sidney Korshak, he acknowledged Korshak had represented the team in one matter, but he said he did not know that Korshak was one of his limited partners in the Acapulco Towers. But this story, as of tonight, continues on other fronts. Art Modell, owner of the Cleveland Browns, is the subject of a four-part series that began yesterday in the Akron Beacon Journal. Part two, it's on the newsstands today, focuses on Mr. Modell's long history of gambling associations. Leonard Toast, the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, announced last week he was considering selling part of the franchise and turning over part to his daughter. It was alleged this was due to heavy gambling losses. Toast told me that his losses at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas were somewhere near $1 million last year, and his losses in New Jersey casinos in excess of that amount. But he told me his debts are paid and that the sale and transfer are for estate purposes only. Now, in all of these cases, we remind you, this is not a question of guilt by association, but rather whether questionable associations violate the NFL's own rules. As to illegal activities, a highly placed official in the Justice Department told me today that there are investigations into drugs, gambling, and pro football. Now, the NFL, of course, is concerned about its own vulnerability, and Commissioner Rozelle told me he has stepped up his vigilance on the sidelines. We will continue our investigation from the front lines. Next week, a story about unanswered questions on the role of the police in a famous, still unresolved gun battle. Four TV cameras recorded it in 88 seconds. Five demonstrators against the Ku Klux Klan were killed in Greensboro, North Carolina. And now, 3 years later, new evidence suggests police knew there would be violence and did nothing to stop it. This program is called 88 Seconds in Greensboro. It is next week on Frontline. I'm Jessica Savage.
For a transcript of this program, please send $4 to Frontline, Box 322, Boston, Massachusetts, 02134. Frontline is produced for the Documentary Consortium by WGBH Boston, which is solely responsible for its content. Major funding for Frontline was provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this station and other public television stations nationwide, and by the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies. For over 100 years, providing worldwide business and personal insurance through independent agents and brokers.
Natural historian David Attenborough is author-narrator of Life on Earth, the 3,500 million year epic saga of the development of life on this planet. Join David Attenborough for Life on Earth, Sundays at 7 on your Channel 8.
This is WDCN-TV Nashville, the public television station for Middle Tennessee and Southern Kentucky, with programming from the Public Broadcasting Service. Certain portions of this program are adult in nature. Please use your own judgment about allowing young people to view it.
Aladdin Industries Incorporated has graciously provided funds for local acquisition and promotion of the Great Performances series.
You are invited to this Great Performances 10th anniversary celebration. Great Performances is made possible by grants from Exxon, the Corporation for